Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, as federal immigration arrests surge across New York under Trump's escalating mass deportation campaign, rural communities are feeling the strain. But in South Fallsburg, one grassroots effort is pushing back, not with protests, but with a children's summer camp offering safety, support, and a much-needed sense of normalcy. Help is also back for the new farmers in the Catskills after a federal funding freeze put the program on pause. Cornell Cooperative Extension's beginning farmer program is now restarting. We check in with our own Kimberly Izar, who has both of those stories. And a new historical marker in Loch Sheldrick honors the legendary Brown's Hotel and the history of the Borscht Belt. We'll meet the new editor of the Sullivan County Democrat at Science Stories with Joe Johnson, featuring plastic-eating caterpillars. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. At this hour, the Senate is beginning to debate President Trump's request to rescind about $9 billion in federal funding. The money is earmarked for international efforts to combat famine and disease, as well as the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Trump administration is holding back about $140 million allocated by Congress to help communities fight fentanyl and other drug overdoses. Sources inside the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tell NPR key life-saving programs are being disrupted. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
President Trump has made fighting fentanyl deaths a key part of his second term as he did in his first term. But four CDC staff members, speaking on condition of anonymity because they fear retribution, told NPR roughly $140 million for the overdose data to action program have been held back by the DOGE cost-cutting team and the Office of Management and Budget. All four said they fear delays will lead to the funding being cut or canceled altogether. These are lives at stake, said one CDC staffer. Trump administration officials haven't responded to NPR's request for comment. Public health departments around the U.S. say they've paused spending on key local and state harm reduction programs until the federal funding is freed up. Brian Mann, NPR News, Washington.
Half of states and the District of Columbia are suing the U.S. Department of Education over its decision to freeze more than $6 billion in education grants for K-12 schools and adult education. North Carolina is one of those states. Robert Taylor is the superintendent of Wake County Public Schools. His district includes Raleigh and surrounding areas. Taylor spoke to NPR's Morning Edition.
Without these federal funding allocations, it puts us in a position where we have to pivot at a very short notice. Many schools will start in late August, but we already have over 40 year-round schools that have started. So having to make that change now is a significant impact.
The Supreme Court ruled this week the administration can resume dismantling the Education Department while the case plays out. Stocks opened higher this morning. Stocks opened mixed this morning as the Labor Department reported that wholesale prices held steady last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Wholesale prices barely budged between May and June. The wholesale price of goods jumped during the month, but that was offset by the falling price of services. Over the last 12 months, wholesale prices are up 2.3%. The news comes a day after the Labor Department reported a jump in inflation at the retail level last month, which is fueled in part by President Trump's double-digit tariffs. Stock in Johnson & Johnson rose after the company reported better-than-expected quarterly profits. J&J also raised its forecast for the full year. The drug and medical device maker says it expects some game-changing
This is NPR.
Hey there, I'm Jason Dole, letting you know that we here at Radio Catskill are facing an uncertain future. You may have heard about the threats to our federal funding, that we may lose funds that were already approved, and it's true. Because of actions in Washington, D.C., we may lose a quarter of our annual budget. Polls show that Americans oppose these cuts by 2-1, but these lawmakers think they know better than local folks like you. They know better than you what you should hear, what you shouldn't, and what constitutes quality news and information. Congressmen, senators, sitting in D.C., making that call for you. And just for the sake of politics, they're messing with a cherished public resource and pushing stations like ours to the point of crisis. Of course, this isn't just a crisis for us, it's a crisis for the whole community. Radio Catskill's a trusted source of emergency alerts, local news, and cultural programming, and that's why it's more important than ever for you to support this station now at WJFFradio.org. That's WJFFradio.org. If we have to make painful cuts, it will have a negative impact on our whole region. It'll affect the many local events, businesses, nonprofit organizations that we support on air. It'll affect our ability to bring local voices on air to voice local concerns. So please, do what you can. Help us out during our summer fun drive. Go to WJFFradio.org, make a donation, and if you can, spread the word. Share the link. Tell your friends and family we need their help too. Donate now at WJFFradio.org. Again, that's WJFFradio.org. Thank you so much. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Arm, with the new podcast series Tech Unheard. Arm CEO Renee Haas talks to tech company leaders who are working to help shape the future of computing. Available on all podcast platforms. Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. And as you heard from Jason Dole there, it's our summer fun drive, and we do need your support. Right now on the Senate floor, they're debating whether or not to rescind previously approved federal funding for stations like ours. It's going on at this moment, and that threat is real. So it's essential that we meet our fundraising goals in our summer fund drive. And your financial support is essential in providing our vital service to our community. So stand with us at this moment and donate right now at 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. In the last hour, we heard from Jessica and Alana and Milton donating online. And Milton says he's a summer resident and he enjoys our program. So happy summer, Milton. And thank you for tuning in and listening to Radio Catskill. Show your support, whether you're a full-time resident, summer resident, you're listening to us somewhere other than the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. I'm joining the studio by our own Kimberly Izar. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming in. We're at 69% of our $55,000 goal.
Almost
so that's
there.
Really good. So yeah, we need more folks to send in their donations now if they can. And 845-482-4141 or WJFF Radio is where you can do that and support the great local journalism that is coming out of here. Kim Kimberly Izar is doing a lot of that. You've got two stories for us today.
I sure do.
Let's start out with what's going on locally when it comes to some of these reactions to the Trump administration's federal, surge in immigration arrests.
I mean, it's a really scary time.
Yeah.
We have been talking to immigration advocates from several different organizations, and the general consensus is that there's a lot of fear and anxiety with the growing immigration raids. The Trump administration has said that he will essentially push forward an effort that includes the largest immigration deportation effort that we have ever seen in the U.S. But I have a really exciting story that I'm really excited to share that looks at some positive grassroots organizing for youth. We have been seeing the rise in immigration arrests, according to newly obtained federal data. Like I said, this comes after Trump's efforts to mass deport thousands of immigrants. And this has created a lot of fear and anxiety. But some grassroots organizations are really springing into action. And I saw that firsthand here in Sullivan County. In South Fallsburg, there is a new children's summer camp for rural and migrant families. And they are creating a safe space for kids just to be kids. And here is some of my visit. Just off of New York 42 in South Fallsburg, about a dozen kids are gathered around a TV watching a short film about the environment.
Environmental justice. Where is it? I bet you don't even know what that means. Maybe you think it's some primetime cop show on TV.
It's a hot July day, and the old parking lot outside what used to be St. Andrew's Episcopal Church, now the Spark Center, is sprinkled with chalk, colorful bottles of bubbles, and soccer balls. Inside, Adriana Magana from the Center for Bioregional Living in Ellenville is teaching a workshop for the Rural and Migrant Ministry's first summer day program in South Fallsburg, New York. She's talking about how the environment impacts rural communities like Sullivan County.
Because it is our communities that are most affected by environmental justice issues, by issues of pollution, by issues of dumping, by issues of trash.
Maganya's workshop is just one of several activities at the Rural and Migrant Ministry's inaugural summer camp. It's a new program for Sullivan County youth ages 9 to 14 to enjoy the summer and relax. Rural and Migrant Ministry is a nonprofit that works with rural and migrant communities across New York State.
We are at the Spark Center, which is in South Fallsburg, and we are really excited because this is the first time at our new location in South Fallsburg that we're offering a summer day program for this week, July 7th to the 12th, and connecting with the community, having young youth from middle school age, pretty much 9 to 14, come for activities. We are all about empowerment, doing different team building activities.
That's Angela Diudo. She's the Rural and Migrant Ministry's regional coordinator. She says that rural and migrant families are facing a lot of stress and fear right now. The Trump administration has escalated its growing immigration raids across the country and right here in New York State. Just across the Delaware River, three people were detained by ICE at a popular pizzeria in Honesdale, Pennsylvania, earlier this year. Up in Sackett's Harbor, a family of three kids and a mother were detained by ICE on a dairy farm. They were later released after significant public pressure.
A portion of the children that are here are migrant families, and particularly here in Sullivan County, a lot of migrant families are in the poultry packing and, duck farms, chicken farms, all that. And so with parents, working long, long hours, children are not exposed to any summer fun and just to be able to be children. And so we're really excited to offer this. And also just to also offer it to youth in the community, because it is, it's an economic hardship in general for Sullivan County youth to have to for the families to pay for summer camp. So we offer this.
Diudo says the week-long program is all about giving kids a chance to enjoy their summers without having to worry about the risk of a potential immigration raid.
We went swimming yesterday at Morningside Park. We're doing tie-dye shirts tomorrow. We did bracelet making. We're doing different art projects. We're doing some painting tomorrow. Just having fun. Outside, throwing the ball around. Just being kids.
And kids being kids is what every child deserves. Wilmer Jimenez is the chief program officer for Rural and Migrant Ministry. He says that he's excited to see the program take off in Sullivan County so that more families can access their services.
For the past few years, we have had programs in the other regions, but Sullivan County, we haven't had the opportunity to have a summer day program, which that's why we decided to implement it for first time here, which is only 1 week. Hopefully in next year, we can be 2 weeks. And we believe it's really important because I feel like a lot of our community don't really know a lot of the resources that are available for them in this community, just because, again, we think it's very isolated. Right now, I feel like we have people in town because it's summer, but during winter is different.
And the Spark Education Center's summer program isn't just for the summer. It's open all year round. The South Fallsburg Center is also home to other programming like Bags for Justice. It's a youth-owned cooperative business where young people learn to design and print t-shirts and tote bags. According to Rural and Migrant Ministry, youth cooperatives in rural areas are especially rare. Jimenez says the summer camp is just the start. He's especially excited about connecting more rural and migrant youth to services in Sullivan County.
I think it's also important for parents to come in and get to know other parents and also the resources available and the opportunities out there for themselves and their children.
In South Fallsburg, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Kimberly Izar is still here with us. And Kim, great to hear some good news there out of everything that you hear in terms of this issue going on and how the local community is reacting.
Definitely. And I think sometimes, you know, rural communities are often portrayed as being a bit of a resource desert. And I think that this was my first time actually seeing rural and migrant ministries work in person.
Yeah, you went there in person.
Yes. And oh my goodness, it was such a fun day.
Look at the smile on your face.
Yes, it was such a fun day. I mean, I was there when the kids were watching this like environmental justice short film documentary, learning about their environment here in the Catskills. I wasn't able to stick around for the tie-dye and some of the more interactive workshops that they had, but it was such a beautiful thing to see kids just being kids, especially during such a difficult time, because, you know, immigration and these raids impact not just adults, it impacts the whole family. Yeah. And sometimes, as Angela said, kids are hearing their parents talk about having difficult conversations. So it was nice for them to just relax and enjoy the summer.
Well, if your parents are anxious, you're going to absorb that anxiety, right? If you're, you know, in that fear that could happen. So it's good to have a place where they can just be kids, as you said.
Absolutely.
And Rural and Migrant Ministries does great work in the area. They've got some other stuff coming up.
They do. Yes. I wanted to lift up one event that they have going on in August. From August 17th to 23rd, they have an overnight youth camp. I'm not sure if it's in South Fallsburg, but I believe it's somewhere in upstate New York. You could find more information at ruralmigrantministry.org. There's some more information there that you can find.
And you've got another story for us well, which includes more good news. You're the good news person today.
Yes.
Yay.
Yes.
Good news for beginning farmers in the Catskills. This is a follow-up story.
That's right. I was at the legislature last week, and Melinda Madow from the Sullivan County Cornell Cooperative Extension shared some good news for beginner farmers in the Hudson Valley Catskills region. The Beginner Farmer Program is back, which is so exciting. This is a program that pairs farmers in the region who have been operating for less than 10 years with farmer mentors, group training, a bunch of networking. And I spoke with Melinda Madow, who is the Agriculture and Food Systems Senior Issue Leader of the Extension, about the program returning. So let's talk about the Beginner Farmer Program, because I know that we have some updates here. In March, the Trump administration froze over $2 million that was previously allocated and approved for the County Cornell Cooperative Extension, and that included the Beginner Farmer Program. CCE had to pause program operations. What is the latest on this?
Yep. So the latest is we've been able to unpause the program because our account has been unfrozen. So we're able to continue the Beginner Farmer Mentorship Program. We're able to continue the different workshops and technical assistance, especially the workshops that we are offering for free.
I mean, that is really great news to hear for the farmers that you work with and then also just the broader community. When did you hear about the funds being unfrozen?
I want to say maybe May, I believe, maybe beginning of May.
And, you know, now that the program is back, tell me more about the kinds of farmers part of the program. There's 11 mentees, correct?
Correct. Yep. So now that we have the program back, we have the Beginner Farmer Mentorship Program is moving forward again. We're basically, we have 11 mentors, farmers in the area that are mentoring 11 mentees. And as part of that, you know, they have different farm visits and just providing them with support through the program is about a year, but we adjusted a little bit due to the freeze. So over the course of through March 1st.
And tell me a little bit more about just the program itself. What kind of resources and programs does the program provide? I know it's a very popular and in-demand initiative.
Mm-hmm. So outside of the Beginner Farmer Mentorship Program, we've been able to offer different workshops for free, you know, ranging from different, you know, learning how to use different equipment, different funding resources, different production workshops, especially being able to bring in different speakers. It's helped to, you know, offset those costs for it and basically, you know, provide that one-on-one support as well.
Yeah, and I know that the program was on pause for a few months. Could you give folks a sense as to essentially what was lost when the beginner farmer program wasn't operating for those months, especially during key growth seasons of the year?
Well, you know, we've had to push back the beginner farmer mentorship program, and, you know, everything kind of got a late start. So I guess that, you know, that had an impact. We had to limit the programs that we were doing, or not, you know, not have the funding to provide for those programs. But yeah, it was only, you know, a few months, so it wasn't too bad.
Yeah, no, that's good to hear. Are there any concerns about other program funding? You know, the extension is expecting that might still be at risk.
You know, right now, I guess it's up in the air. So we just take it as it comes, and, you know, and hopefully the program doesn't freeze again. But yeah, I guess I don't really have an answer for that.
Yeah. Well, it's really exciting that the beginner farmer program is back. I know a lot of folks are, I'm sure, excited about that. How mm-hmm. can folks stay plugged in as you reopen the program?
They can go to our website, sullivancce.org, or they can, you know, give us a call at 292-6180, or you can sign up for our monthly email. They can email me at mm2592@cornell.edu to get on that list.
That's our own Kimberly Izar speaking to Melissa Meadow of Cornell Cooperative Extension. Thank you so much for that good news you're bringing us today. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back with science stories from Joe Johnson. Kind of some good news, I guess, if you consider plastic-eating caterpillars. Good news. That's next on Radio Chatskill. And, of course, our summer fun drive is still happening. We need to hear from you at 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org.
It's Layla Faldin from NPR's Morning Edition. The demonization of fact-based journalism is one of democracy's biggest threats. This aversion to truth has taken hold as the number of local newsrooms has dwindled, leaving reams of disinformation to fill the void. In public radio, we have a responsibility to counteract disinformation. This station is an oasis amid all the noise and fiction. Having a reporter at the school board meeting, at City Hall, that is our resistance to the undermining of a free press. We resist by being there, by providing platforms for people to see themselves reflected and to see difference. We resist by building bridges and by holding people to account. We do it thanks to you. You give us the tools we need to fight attacks on truth by donating to this station. Here's how.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
Give us a call at 845-482-4141 or go online and donate at wjffradio.org. Your support is more important than ever. 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. We are 69% of the way toward our goal. We need to meet that goal by Friday. We can also meet it sooner. That's no problem. 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. That's how you can support us right now during our summer fun drive. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and our resident science guy is Joe Johnson, and he's got some more of strange and fascinating phenomena this week, including mysterious lights above thunderstorms, those dazzling summer meteor showers this month, and plastic-eating caterpillars.
Plastic-eating caterpillars, yeah. This was a pre-publication article that I came across from the Society for Experimental Biology. This was a conference that was held last week, and it concerns the common waxworm, which is the larval form of the wax moth. And if you're an ice fisherman, you may know them as bait. We use them as bait. But the story goes like this. Back in 2017, one of the authors of the study, who's a biologist from the University of Cantabria in Spain and also a beekeeper, took some waxworms out of one of her beehives, and she put them in a plastic bag. And an hour later, she found that they had started to chew holes in the bag, which was made of polyethylene. Now, waxworms live in beehives, and they eat the beeswax. I'm a beekeeper myself, and we have to watch out for them. They actually eat the beeswax that the cells in the combs are made out of. Now, beeswax is a polymer, which means it's made out of a lot of little units all strung together, polymer, many pieces, just like plastics are. So evolution has equipped the waxworms with enzymes and metabolic pathways, digestive pathways, to digest the wax. So it's not too surprising that they can digest polyethylene too, which is a polymer. Now, normally it would take centuries to degrade polyethylene. If you just buried it, you know, you can come back 100 years later and it's still going to be there. Plastic pollution is a big worldwide problem. It's, you know, plastics found everywhere. Bottom of the ocean, they looked on the bottom of the Marianas Trench and they found plastic bags down there. Now, this study looks at the pathways of metabolism, that specifically how the plastic is broken down and how it's used by the waxworm. And what they found is that there was an enzyme in the saliva and the gut of the waxworms that turn the polyethylene into lipids, which are like fats and oils and waxes, which the waxworm would then store as body fat. Okay, so you get fat waxworms.
Fat plastic waxworms. Now, do we think that these waxworms could help with playing a role in tackling this plastics crisis?
They do. They do. There's a couple of ways we can do this. First of all, we got to get past one problem, though. They found that a diet of pure plastic basically killed the waxworms in a couple of days.
Well, makes sense.
It's not what they normally eat. So they're looking at co-supplemental foods that they can give to the waxworms to eat with the plastic that would allow them to eat the plastic without dying. Now, you're asking how can this be used? Well, a couple of different ways. We could mass rear waxworms on a co-supplemented polyethylene diet and use them to break down the plastics and keep them out of landfills in the ocean. You know, then you end up with a bunch of fat waxworms, which you could then use for aquaculture food to raise fish or even feed them to the chickens, like I would probably do. We could also then explore the plastic biodegradation pathway. In other words, the chemistry of how it happens and perhaps chemically engineer new ways to break down plastics. So there's some light on the horizon here.
Why wasn't this ever mentioned in The Very Hungry Caterpillar? All right, from plastivores to red sprites. Now, these are not any kind of insect or animal. Red sprites, a weather phenomena.
It's a weather phenomena, yeah, associated with thunderstorms. So this came from an Instagram post from astronaut Nicole Ayers aboard the International Space Station. Basically, he took a photo of a thunderstorm that was over the Mexican-U.S. border from the ISS, and he captured an image of a sprite. What it shows is that it almost looks like a flower to me. It's an upwards discharge from the top of the cloud upwards, and it, like I said, it looks like a flower. It starts out blue, and then it turns purple and pink, and the pink kind of branches out and fades away into space.
I'm getting a little jellyfish out of this.
That's what a lot of people compare them to. Yeah, it's jellyfish. There's a website called spritacular.org that NASA has started that users can view and post images of sprites. They're really hard to photograph. Now, the history on them is this. They've been talked about and have been reported for hundreds of years, but it wasn't until 1989 that somebody was actually able to photograph one. But let's back up. Let's talk about the physics of lightning. So lightning comes from clouds called cumulonimbus clouds, and they develop this charge separation, the particles going up and down, kind of like you walk across a rug and you develop a static charge, but on a hugely large scale. And so the top of the cloud tends to become more positive because the particles that lose electrons are lighter and they tend to go to the top of the cloud. And then the heavier, more hail-like particles that gain the electrons, they end up on the bottom of the cloud. So the bottom of the cloud turns negative. So most lightning is what we call negative lightning. It's where, you know, the electrons that building up in the bottom of the cloud streak to the ground. And it's that familiar lightning strike that we've all seen. That's about 95% of lightning, but about 5% of lightning is called positive lightning. And this comes from the top of the cloud. It actually draws electrons up from the ground to the top of the cloud. And there's about 10 times more powerful than negative lightning.
So they flash as these kind of glowing plumes or mm-hmm. spindles just for like a fraction of a second.
Nanoseconds. And I should say, I got to back up, milliseconds.
Even shorter.
Milliseconds.
Of course, these short-lived flashes of light high above thunderstorms have a name, a category called transient luminous events or TLEs.
TLEs is what they call them. Yeah, it's an electrical discharge in the upper atmosphere of the mesosphere and the ionosphere, usually above lightning storms. There's actually a whole bunch of them, too.
I was going to ask you, are there other things besides red sprites?
There are. And this is where scientists kind of show their sense of humor. There are blue jets, elves, trolls, pixies, and the most recently discovered ghosts. And most of them are abbreviations. Like sprite is this long scientific abbreviation that I won't bore you with.
Because they're so short-lived, they must be hard to study.
They're very hard to study, sure. Like I said, they weren't photographed until 1989. Most of them are photographed in the Midwest where it's very, very flat. And you can see a thunderstorm coming from a long ways away. You can see above the thunderstorm. That's where these things happen. They're usually photographed from about 30 to 150 miles away, just because that's the angle that you're going to have to look at to see these sprites above the storm.
With climate change and the rise in the intensity and frequency of thunderstorms, will we be seeing more of these kinds of TLEs?
Sure, theoretically, yeah. More energy in the atmosphere is going to produce more of these transient luminous events.
Well, let's talk about another event in the sky, meteor showers. Apparently, there's some epic meteor showers this July.
There are a couple of good ones coming up. Now, meteor showers happen when the Earth moving in its orbit intersects the debris trail left behind by usually a comet. Okay, the exception is the Geminids, which are in December. They come from an asteroid. But what happens is, as the comet moves through the solar system, it leaves debris behind. It leaves little chunks of, you know, ice and dust behind. And when the Earth intersects that, these debris get pulled into the atmosphere. They fall into the atmosphere. And they burn up in the atmosphere, and they form what we call meteors, or commonly called shooting stars.
What do we have coming up?
Well, we have first the Alpha Capricornids, which are going to peak on July 29th and 30th, and the Perseids, which are going to peak around August 12th. Let's talk about how to view them first.
Yeah, do you need special equipment?
You don't. You need your eyeballs. That's all you need. So, first of all, you want to find a dark area. The darker, the better. You know, be safe. Get away from city lights if you can. Get yourself a comfortable chair, because this is not something that is going to happen in 5 minutes and you're going to be done with it. Get yourself some bug repellent, too. Now, let your eyes adapt for about 10 to 15 minutes in the dark so that you can really see faint things. Don't look at your phone. That's the problem. A lot of people, they look at their phone and it closes their irises down so they can't see anymore. Now, you're going to look at the general area that is called the radiant point. This is where the meteors are going to appear to originate from, and it's usually named for the constellation that the meteors appear to kind of shoot out of. Most meteor showers are best viewed after midnight, so yes, you're going to have to stay up late for this. And I would really, as I have in the past, urge people to get an astronomy app for their phone. It's not just good for finding, you know, constellations so you can see where the meteors are coming from. There's just so many good apps out there. And once again, get yourself one that presents in red so that it will not close your irises down. It won't affect your night vision. Okay, so here's the information. The Alpha Capricornids, this is debris from a short-period comet. It's going on now, but it peaks around July, the night of July 29th into the morning of the 30th. It should be good viewing a few nights before or after. And the radiant point is the constellation Capricorn, which this time of year is low in the southern sky after midnight. So you're going to want to look generally to the south. And once again, this is July 29th into the 30th. The Alpha Capricornids are known to produce about 5 to 10 meteors per hour. But they could be more. And here's the cool thing. This storm usually produces very bright shooting stars and occasionally fireballs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, fireball is a meteor that's made it into the lower atmosphere, so it's moving slower. I've had the occasion to see fireballs a couple of times in my life because I'm always out viewing the stars, and they're pretty spectacular. Now, the moon on the 29th is going to be a waxing crescent, and it's going to set about 10:30, so perfect viewing. The sky will be very dark. Let's hope we have some good weather.
And then the Perseids are going to be coming up around the 12th and 13th is when they peak.
Yeah, the night of the 12th
of August.
The morning of the 13th of August, yes. Now, this is debris from the comet Swift-Tuttle. This is the best-known meteor shower, though, because it's in the summertime when a lot of people are out at night, and also it just produces a lot of meteors. The radiant point is the area of Perseus or Cassiopeia in the northeastern sky after midnight. So once again, orient your chair, look to the northeast. It can produce about 25 meteors per hour or up to 100 meteors per hour sometimes at its peak. Now, I saw what's called an outburst back in, it was 1987 or 1988, I can't remember, when there were dozens of meteors per minute. It was, I liken it to being in a shooting gallery. It was amazing. It was probably the coolest thing I've ever seen in the sky. But the problem now, though, is that the moon is in the waning gibbous phase on August 12th. and it's going to be in the southeastern sky. So if you're looking to the northeast, it'll be to your right, and it'll be lighting up the sky. So see if you can kind of block out the light of the moon with something, and you should be able to see some pretty cool shooting stars.
This comet that orbits the sun every 133 years?
Yeah, Comet Swift-Tuttle.
Wow.
It's a long-duration comet. It's a big comet. So it left behind a lot of junk as it flies through the solar system. It leaves a lot of debris behind. And so this is one of the reasons why it's a good, you know, meteor shower. Now, depending on where the Earth in its orbit moves through that cloud, moves through that trail, that depends on whether we're going to have a really good year or not. Sometimes it'll just edge it, and sometimes we'll go right through the middle of it and get a really good shower.
Look up.
Look up, always.
What was it Casey Kasem said? Keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the stars, yes, this time reaching for the meteors.
Jack Horkheimer was the guy who always said, keep looking up.
Joe Johnson, thank you so much for your science stories this week.
My pleasure as always.
Thanks to Joe for that. And we'll take a break when we come back. A new historical marker in Loch Sheldrake honoring the legendary Brown's Hotel. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
We here at Radio Catskill are facing an uncertain future. You may have heard about the threats to our federal funding, and it's true. Because of actions in Washington, D.C., we may lose a quarter of our annual budget. Congressmen, senators, they're messing with a cherished public resource and pushing stations like ours to the point of crisis. This isn't just a crisis for us, it's a crisis for the whole community. Radio Catskill is a trusted source of emergency alerts, local news, and cultural programming, and that's why it's more important than ever for you to support this station now at WJFFradio.org. If we have to make painful cuts, it will have a negative impact on our whole region. It'll affect the many local businesses, nonprofit organizations that we support on air. It'll affect our ability to voice local concerns. So please, help us out during our summer fund drive. Make a donation, and if you can, spread the word. Share the link. Tell your friends and family we need their help too. Donate now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you so much.
You can also call 845-482-4141, WJFFradio.org. The threat is real. It's right now happening on the Senate floor. They are debating this rescissions package at this moment in Washington to take away a previously approved funding. Support us now as this threat becomes a reality. 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. It's our summer fund drive, and your support is more important than ever. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The golden era of the Catskills is living on through the growing network of historical markers, thanks to the Borscht Belt Historical Marker Project. Tomorrow, the project unveils its latest marker in Loch Sheldrake, honoring Brown's Hotel and other iconic resorts that once made the area a cultural hotspot. Joining us now with more is Marisha Scheinfeld, photographer, historian, and one of the driving forces behind the project. Marisha, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, we've had you on before to talk about the Borscht Belt Historical Marker Project. You've got your 12th marker in the series coming up tomorrow at Loch Sheldrake. How do you choose which locations or stories to highlight next? There's so many.
Yeah, well, you know, when starting out with this project, you know, we knew the vast amount of hotels, over 500, you know, thousands of bungalows and boarding houses. And there's a really wonderful list by the Catskills Institute that breaks it down to towns. So you can see, you know, arguably how many towns are in Livingston Manor or Monticello or Fallsburg. And, you know, upon studying that, you see the epicenters. Town of Thompson had a tremendous amount of hotels. Town of Liberty, Town of Fallsburg. That's really like the king of the Catskills. So naturally, our markers went there first. You know, we're now looking to, you know, the smaller towns, where there were just, of course, many hotels, but, you know, like Spring Glen, Jeffersonville, you know, and considering new markers, all in an attempt to get to 20. And we're so excited about 12 because when we started this, there was not one. And, it's just really been a joy of a project to work on and very exciting. And, we feel like we're doing some good work with history.
Yeah, and Brown's Hotel and Loch Sheldrake's other resorts are legendary. Are there specific stories or memories from Brown's you're excited to spotlight with this marker?
Of course. I mean, Brown's is one of those big ones, like Grossinger's, like Concord, that were on the map. Iconic. they were way more than just vacation spots. They were these cultural epicenters, and people like Jerry Lewis, Sid Caesar, Joan Rivers, Liberace, Jackie Mason, Sammy Davis Jr., even household names, I was looking at old ads, Suzanne Summers and Regis and Kathy Lee came to the Browns. So it's just, it really crosses so many different decades and into so many realms, not only of music, but comedy and entertainment. And in addition to the Browns, which really, like I said, iconic as ever, the marker also highlights the area's ties to the golden age of boxing. There was a tremendous lineage of boxing up here. And also the evolution of many historic Borscht Belt hotels into something new. One of the greatest examples is the Carmel Hotel, which is today's Stage Door Manor, a really, like, you know, nationally acclaimed theater arts camp. But there's other places like the New Roxy that are New Hope and Vacation Village that used to be the Evans. So I find it really wonderful and cool how the Borscht Belt's constantly morphing. And really, when you think about it, you know, not really, you know, dead.
And there's so many interesting stories and narratives. You mentioned the folks that played there, the famous names that we know, the golden age of boxing, but also ties to gangsters. So talk about like that. That's a kind of a more unknown part of the legend of the Catskills.
Yeah, I owe a lot of that to John Conway, who we know is Sullivan County historian, an absolute gem. And Conway has a number of, you know, lectures and talks on the area's ties to Jewish gangsters, because just like, you know, others, they wanted to come up here for a vacation, but often they used the remoteness and the desolateness of the area as dumping grounds for bodies. And it is, not even rumored, but true that bodies were dumped in Loch Sheldrake. There's a lot of tall tales, but when you look at the history of gangsters coming up from the city, you see that many of them went to all these hotels. And lots of unique and fringe stories going on.
It wouldn't be the Catskills without a tall tale, no matter where you are.
No, it would not. And that's a part of what makes the Catskills so fascinating and beautiful.
And following the marker unveiling tomorrow, there's a film screening of A Walk on the Moon. Why did you choose that film? And talk about how it connects to the stories of the Borscht Belt.
Sure. Well, A Walk on the Moon is a 1999 movie written by a woman named Pamela Gray. She used to come up to bungalows in Mountaindale and in Swan Lake as a kid. She started out as a poet, and I think the story is after she saw Dirty Dancing come out, while it's such an iconic film, she and I talked about this, she felt like it didn't tell the story of the bungalows, which is a whole other Borscht Belt Catskill experience that sometimes gets overshadowed by the dominating hotels. And Pamela went back to school and worked on this as a, you know, graduate in California. And the film took about 5 years, but it got picked up by, Dustin Hoffman's company. And what's so cool about the film is it's set in Sullivan County in 1969. It's set amid the backdrop of the moon landing, which happened in July, and a few weeks later, Woodstock. Mm. It has such a great cast of characters from Diane Lane to Liev Schreiber, Viggo Mortensen, Anna Paquin, and the soundtrack is amazing. And we thought that, you know, this is such a beautiful film to show during the summer. And while I love Dirty Dancing, and there's absolutely no shade to it, A Walk on the Moon felt like this was the time for it. Mm-hmm.
What's next after tomorrow's dedication in Loch Sheldrake? What are the next historical markers or other events you guys have coming up?
Sure. So I will say, for anyone listening, we have about 18 tickets left to the film, and it will sell out. And we're screening it in an iconic, intact Borscht Belt nightclub. So you literally can walk into a Borscht Belt nightclub that's still being used for a night with us. Ceilings are circular and the seats are red. Very cool.
Very cool.
After this, it's so cool. You don't even know it's there. It's in Vacation Village, and it's so special. We're so happy to have access to it. After this, we're having August 23rd in Woodburn. That's going to be a nighttime dedication at like 9:30 at night. We're going to hopefully do some projections of slideshows on the buildings. And then we have later this fall, October 5th in Parksville, which is going to be a great event with live music and so much fun. And then Livingston Manor to wrap up the year. We're going to do that October 18th, and we're involved with the Catskill Art Space, and we're so excited.
If someone listening has the personal stories or artifacts from the Borscht Belt era, how can they share those with you or get involved?
Sure. Well, one, don't throw anything away. Two, Bethel Woods is going to be at our dedication tomorrow, and I'm pretty sure every dedication here on out, they're doing an oral history. They got a grant to record oral histories, and we're one of their partners. So you can come sit with them. They have a lovely recording team, and your story, whatever it be, especially, of course, they love like the 1969 Woodstock story, which is why this movie is so great, will go into their archive. So that's a wonderful place. You can contact Bethel Woods for this grant if you don't come to one of our dedications. And if you have any materials, you know, reach out to us. We are not an archive, but we do exhibit from time to time. And I'm happy to direct people to like long-term repositories such as the Center for Jewish History or other places that if they really want to donate it will be, you know, a longstanding place to give it to.
That's Marissa Scheinfeld with the Borscht Belt Marker Historical Marker Project. They are dedicating their latest marker, their 12, at Loch Sheldrake tomorrow. You can find out more about the historic markers and all of the great things they do at borscht belt historical marker project.org. Marissa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. And just a shorter handle, maytheborschtbewithyou.org.
Great. Perfect. That's easier to remember, too. Thank you so much.
It is. Thank you so much. And if you want to come to the film, just come.
All right. Great.
All right. Thanks so much.
Take care.
All right.
The Borscht Belt Historical Marker Project is preserving these great stories in our area. And we're able to bring you those great stories and the work that folks are doing, like Marissa and others, in our area, thanks to support from listeners like you. We're listener-supported public radio, and we're here to bring you that, so help support it. 845-482-4141, wjffradio.org. I'm laughing again at May the Borscht Be With You, .org. Thank you again, Marissa. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to meet the new editor of the Sullivan County Democrat, a name that we're already familiar with here, and you might know, too. It's Isabel Braverman. After this break, it's Radio Chatskill.
I'm Brooke Gladstone from On the Media. And as you can deduce from the name of the show, we track the evolving media, the right and the wrong of it, across myriad platforms. But the truth is, the best thing about it, and I'm talking here about the fact-based media, the independent media, is that it's here at all. Over the 3 decades I've been watching, there have been countless bombardments and forays and brawls, but I've never seen it attacked with such focus and ferocity as now. Especially our own little corner of it, public media. Your media, we hope. You know, you could stand up for public media right here at home. Start a monthly gift or add to your existing one. Here's how you do it.
Give now at WJFFradio.org. Protect public media and stand with Radio Catskill. WJFFradio.org. Thank you so much.
Or call 845-482-4141, WJFFradio.org. Your support, more important than ever during this hour, the Senate convened to debate and pass, it looks like, a rescission of federal funding for public media. All the public radio stations and television stations throughout the country, pulling back previously approved funding. That includes Radio Catskill. It's about 25% of our funding. We're listener supported. The majority of our funding comes from listeners like you. And it's more important than ever that we get that support from you and we maintain our strong reserves, because if that 25% gets pulled, we will have to readjust what we're doing here. We're not going anywhere, but we do need to know that you're there with us to keep us going. 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. Donate right now during our summer fun drive. You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and a familiar name to us is stepping into a new role, Isabel Braverman, It's also a familiar newsroom for her. It's the Sullivan County Democrat. They've named Isabel Braverman as their new editor following the departure of Derek Kirk. A Narrowsburg resident and longtime journalist, Braverman previously worked as a staff reporter at the Democrat and brings experience in both journalism and communications, having worked at the Sullivan County Visitors Association and Radio Catskill's One Small Step Project. And the editor of the Sullivan County Democrat, Isabel Braverman, joins us live now. Hi.
Hello.
So good to see you.
Good to see you.
Well, congratulations on the new role. How does it feel to step back into the newsroom, but now in this leadership position?
Yeah, it feels good. It's definitely different, but so far, so good.
What drew you back to the Sullivan County Democrat after your time away from there and back to the newspaper reporting?
Yeah, I really felt that I was missing local news, like, you know, personally, just knowing about what's going on. And I always, you know, want to know more, to find out that information. And so I just thought it would be a great step to come back and be a part of the newsroom there.
So being there before as a reporter, how is that shaping you now as an editor, as the big cheese?
Yeah, you know, like I said, it does feel different being the editor, which I wasn't sure if it was going to feel that way. And I think back to when I was a reporter there and Matt was the editor. And I feel that I learned a lot from him during that time.
Fred Sabert, the publisher.
Matt.
Oh, Matt, you said. Yeah, I thought you said Fred. I can't hear.
Matt Shortall was editor. Right. Yeah.
Well, Fred is still the publisher. Go ahead.
Yes.
So Matt was like sort of a mentor toward you.
Yeah. And coming from being a reporter, you know, I have that knowledge of all the townships, the organizations that we cover, and then bringing that all together as the editor to, you know, assign out stories. It's been an interesting mix.
Now, what's your vision for the Democrat under your leadership? Are there specific topics or communities you hope to amplify?
Yeah, I really think that we can do some great in-depth stories. We actually just had one about local pharmacies that are facing an issue with the cost of drug prescriptions. And I think we can really, you know, go in deep to these stories that are affecting our communities.
You've called local newspapers a lifeline for small communities. What do you think is the biggest challenge facing local journalism right now? I could answer for you, but right. Go ahead.
I think, you know, people want to know what's going on, but they don't necessarily know how to find that information. And so I always say, just pick up the newspaper and read it. And that sounds so simple, but I think that is a challenge that we face, is that people aren't reading the news. They're getting their news from social media or, you know, things like that, that can be inaccurate. And so if you really want to know what's going on, you can read the newspaper.
Well, and we say the same thing here. You know, turn on the radio, we'll tell you. But right. As you said, there's so many things and ways that people can consume media, especially in the digital age. And how do you balance that storytelling in a digital age with, you know, traditional reporting?
Right. You know, that's something we can work on. But we do, you know, post our stories on our website, share some of them on social media. And, you know, I understand that that is how a majority of people probably get their news. So we want to bridge that gap and get it out there.
Talk a little bit about your background here. I mentioned that, you know, you're worked in Sullivan County at the Visitors Association. You worked with us on One Small Step. You worked in Sullivan County for much of your career. How does that local connection sort of also shape what you're looking at as well? You, of course, mentioning the things that people want to know, but just the experiences that you've had yourself locally.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from here. Born and raised. So I do feel very much a part of this community. So I think I'm bringing all of those years to this position. And having worked at the Sullivan County Visitors Association, I really got to know the local businesses, the people behind them, and what they want to see in the county, in our area.
Talk a little bit too about being a mom and an editor, and a woman in a leadership position as well, and what that means for you and for readers and residents.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's definitely a lot. I have a 1.5-year-old daughter, so figuring out childcare.
I'm sorry, I just have to correct you. I know you're a journalist and editor, but it's cute daughter.
Yes, the cutest ever daughter. So yeah, figuring out childcare as I go back to work was challenging. There's definitely a daycare, I'll say it, shortage in the area. And daycares are also facing a lot of challenges with cost and balancing, you know, how much to charge and how much they can pay their employees, finding employees. So I know that daycare is a struggle for many families around here. And luckily, I have family in the area. Mm-hmm. So it's all been good. But yeah, it adds an extra stress.
But also, I think it's important to note that, well, you know, when you think about, you know, editors of newspapers, you got the cigar chomping, you know, guy, a white male. And I'm not sure of the history of the Democrat, but are you the first female editor or one of the only?
No, there have been others. Okay. Yeah.
And so it is important, though, to have that representation. And also for you, as you mentioned, with the editor you had as a mentor, you've got you're going to be mentoring as well.
Yes.
Yeah,
definitely. Something I look forward to, but something that will be a challenge.
You also mentioned in your letter from the editor in your first note to folks in the community a little bit about your background, but also a little bit about the background of the paper. You mentioned that some people confuse the name of the paper with a political party.
Right.
Talk about that.
Right. So it's called the Sullivan County Democrat. And so many people think that it has to do with the Democratic Party. Actually, when I got the job, someone said, oh, I hope you're a Democrat. And I wasn't sure if they were joking or not. And I said, but they weren't joking. I said, oh, no, it's just called that. It's not the Democrats. And she was like, oh. So I talked a little bit about the history of the paper. It started in 1891. At the time, there were many, many local newspapers across the country. Many of them had Republican or Democrat or Independent in the title. And so the name just stuck because that was the original name.
Talk a little bit about, before we go, just having a local media and a vibrant local media in our area. We say that, you know, with you and the River Reporter, or other folks that are doing things digitally, but we're all here together to amplify these stories. Some folks have said, oh, they're your competitors. I'm like, no, they're not. They're not. We're all in this together.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I'm sad to hear the news of the funding that just happened. We can't withstand any more blows to local media. I also wrote about in my editorial a research shows that many counties in the country have only one or none local media. So the fact that we have three great organizations here is really an asset.
Yeah, and we've got some other digital things that are happening as well with folks. And so we look forward to working with you and partnering with you to continue telling these stories of our region. And it is something we all need to band together against, this a coordinated attack, really, on media across the country. And it could impact the local media in rural areas more acutely than in some other places that might be able to withstand it. So it's more important than ever that we all band together. So we're looking forward to continuing our partnership with you. The new editor of the Sullivan County Democrat, Isabel Braverman. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we can only do that with your support, you, the listener, 845-482-4141, wjffradio.org. That's where you can donate to support us. Stand with us as we are facing the most important threat we've ever faced as a public radio station, not just us, but other public media across the country. 845-482-4141, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
We here at Radio Catskill are facing an uncertain future. You may have heard about the threats to our federal funding, and it's true. Because of actions in Washington, D.C., we may lose a quarter of our annual budget. Congressmen, senators, they're messing with a cherished public resource and pushing stations like ours to the point of crisis. This isn't just a crisis for us, it's a crisis for the whole community. Radio Catskill is a trusted source of emergency alerts, local news, and cultural programming, and that's why it's more important than ever for you to support this station now at wjffradio.org. If we have to make painful cuts, it will have a negative impact on our whole region. It'll affect the many local businesses, nonprofit organizations that we support on air. It'll affect our ability to voice local concerns. So please, help us out during our summer fund drive. Make a donation, and if you can, spread the word. Share the link. Tell your friends and family we need their help, too. Donate now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you so much.
You can also call 845-482-4141, WJFFradio.org. Our summer fund drive is underway. We're 69% of the way there, and we have a little bit more to raise before Friday, $55,000 goal. 845-482-4141, or go to WJFFradio.org and make your donation right now and support public radio and for the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania, and beyond. You're listening to WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. There is a marginal risk of severe weather today, according to the National Weather Service. Might see a thunderstorm pop up later this afternoon or in the evening with some gusty winds. There's also an air quality advisory in effect for the region between 2 and 11 tonight. Today, a high of 84. Tonight's low, 69. Tomorrow, we'll see some AM showers with some sunshine later in the day and a high of 85. It's 11 o'clock.